Undiplomatic Discourse today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Philippine president uses a profanity in reference to President Obama and tells the U.S. not to lecture other countries on human rights.
Anti-Americanism, leave us alone, America. This is going to be a theme in foreign policy for as long as the United States continues to play such an outsized role on the world stage.
Actually sounds like a new video for a song called Nobody Speak.
It looks like everybody in the world has just gone crazy. It's not any longer about sitting together, talking, discussing, coming to a decision, but just going to a fist fight right away.
We'll tell you why Ukrainians are talking about that video, plus Black Lives Matter in the UK. That's all ahead today here on The World. All it takes, it seems, is a few expletives aimed at President Obama, and suddenly a lot of people today are talking about Rodrigo Duterte. He's a president of the Philippines, and before we hear what he sounds like, a word of caution. We're talking about vulgar insults here over the next few minutes.
I am a president of a sovereign state, and we have long ceased to be a colony. I do not have any master except the Filipino people. Nobody but nobody. You must be respectful. Don't just throw away questions and statements.
Yeah, that long bleep at the end masks the insult that prompted the White House to cancel a planned meeting today between Obama and Duterte. Here's the context. The Filipino president took office in July, promising a brutal war against drug dealers and criminals, and he's kept that promise. His security forces and vigilantes have reportedly killed more than 2,400 people in the past couple of months, and it's not clear that all of those killed were criminals. But Duterte rejects international criticism of all of this. Yesterday, he was asked about the possibility that President Obama would criticize the Philippines for the extrajudicial killings of suspected drug dealers. Duterte said he would respond by cursing Obama, and he kept that promise, too, in the same statement. In fact, using the Tagalog phrase for son of a bitch. As you heard in the clip above, though, the overall message from Duterte was, I don't take any criticism from the U.S. or any foreign power. I've got Susan Glasser, editor of Politico, to talk this one over. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
So Duterte has said it before. He doesn't want the U.S. lecturing him, especially, he said, when the U.S. invaded Iraq on false pretenses of ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction leading to the deaths of tens of thousands of people. Have we seen the U.S. been called out in such a way by a sitting president?
Clearly, the new president of the Philippines has a colorful way with language and a confrontational style that may not be unfamiliar to Americans watching the rise of Donald Trump and the general coarsening of politics that seems to have happened. However, this critique of the United States as sort of wagging its finger and lecturing to the world has been a pretty consistent theme. Certainly, it has accelerated since the invasion of Iraq, which, after all, was already 13 years ago. And so, you know, we've seen this criticism. Look at how President Vladimir Putin of Russia has turned that critique into an entire international foreign policy platform for him as he goes around the world, setting himself up as sort of the non-American counterbalance to the U.S. in the global order. And I think that that whole conversation really enables individual countries, whether it's the Philippines or someone else, to stand up and say, there's no moral high ground for the United States anymore. Stop telling us what to do.
This has all got to put the White House and the State Department and all of Washington on notice that in 2016, U.S. influence around the world is limited.
Well, there's enormous concern about what the rise of Donald Trump means for continued both U.S. prestige in the world, but also U.S. willingness to engage and to play the role. Rather than sort of reacting against U.S. hegemony or something like that, most of the feedback that I and so many others in Washington have gotten from world leaders and people we talk to internationally is all about, is the United States still going to live up to its commitments to be a big player in the world at large? Does Donald Trump represent some kind of an accident of history, or is he representing kind of a longer term real trend in American politics?
Do you think the coarse language from someone like Rodrigo Duterte, and he's not the only leader who's using coarse language these days, is it symptomatic of something bigger, or is it just a colorful sideshow?
In this sort of social media, Twitter environment where there's a perceived hunger for authenticity on the part of politicians globally, I think you may see more and more of that. it's not just in Asia, it's not just in the United States, it's across Europe as well, that we're seeing a much more populist style of discourse, a realization that with more people able to tune in to the ups and downs of politics, that you're connecting with a broader and broader audience. So I do see that as part of an overall kind of macro trend in politics today.
We'll keep it classy, though, right, Susan?
For now, you know, it would be sad of us to do anything otherwise.
Susan Glasser, editor of Politico. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rodrigo Duterte's use of profanity seems pretty shocking for a head of state. But it got us wondering, is he unusual? The World's History Desk has been peeking behind the diplomatic curtain to check this one out, and Chris Wolf is here to tell us what he found. So let's start with President Duterte, Chris. The White House says he's well known for his colorful language. So what kind of verbal bombs has Duterte dropped in the past?
Well, the words he used about President Obama were relatively mild. For example, he once told the entire nation of Singapore to pretty much just F you. You're a garrison pretending to be a country, he said. He routinely calls all United Nations officials the same phrase that he used about President Obama, that they're the sons and daughters of ladies of ill repute, shall we say. And he's even told that entire organization, the whole of the United Nations, to just F you as well. And then there's the Pope. Last year, he called the Pope the same thing, the son of a so-and-so, after his motorcade caused traffic jams in Manila.
Yeah, so the Pope, this was last year during his visit there?
That's right, yes. But let's not pretend for a moment that holy men or men of the cloth have some kind of monopoly on purity. Martin Luther, the great Protestant reformer, once described Henry VIII, the King of England, as a pig, an ass, a dunghill, the spawn of an adder, a basilisk, a lying buffoon, a mad fool with a frothy mouth.
Okay, you just went way back in the history time machine there. How unusual is Duterte if we're talking about all of history?
Well, he is pretty unusual. I mean, for the last few hundred years, the diplomats have developed this code of decent conduct. And it doesn't mean you can't insult somebody, but you do it intelligently, creatively, with a little nod and a wink. For example, one master of this was another Filipino, a guy called Carlos Romulo, a diplomat who was a short man in the 1940s. And when U.S. generals were kind of making fun of his stature, he said, well, at least I'm a dime amongst nickels.
Okay.
And then there was the British General Wellington, who was never once defeated by the French in battle. But when he met some of the generals he'd beaten at the Congress of Vienna, a diplomatic conference, they turned their backs on him, which was a huge insult. But he says, do not worry, gentlemen, I'm not offended, for I've seen your backs before, meaning when they were running away from the battlefield.
Now, today, we've got the new British foreign minister, Boris Johnson. He's almost, his whole career has been almost defined by insults, hasn't it?
Yeah, he's, for example, just this spring, he won a prize of $1,000 for writing a really filthy limerick about the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Wow. And
then in 2007, he wrote a column saying, I want Hillary Clinton to be president. And Boris Johnson wrote, she's got dyed blonde hair and pouty lips and a steely blue stare like a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital. And
wow.
I have to remind you that this man is now head of the UK's once formidable diplomatic corps.
Yeah, none of this is going to win hearts and minds. So who are the prime suspects when it comes to politicians who insult other politicians?
Well, I think it's kind of when unusual politicians step into high office, what you might call like vulgar populist demagogues, for want of a better word. For example, perhaps, you know, we can include Vladimir Putin in this group at a meeting of leaders of the former Soviet states. He once urged them to work harder and, quote, just stop chewing snot from one year to the next. Then you'd think of people like Mussolini, Napoleon, and then Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan leader, went to the United Nations and got up to the podium right after George W. Bush and said, he sniffed around saying, I smell sulfur, like the fumes of the devil had just been there.
Yeah, what about the United States? You've conspicuously not mentioned anything about the 2016 presidential campaign.
Well, it's up for listeners to make up their own mind about which candidate fits better into which of these categories. But like mostly in American politics, these kind of insults are reserved for other domestic politicians rather than international figures. Bob Dole once wrote about Carter, Ford and Nixon, see no evil, hear no evil, and evil. And then Lyndon B. Johnson on Gerald Ford. He's a nice guy, but he played too much football with his helmet off. And it goes way back to John Quincy Adams, who wrote publicly about Thomas Jefferson. He has a slur upon the moral government of the world.
I mean, we can laugh and joke about it now, but insults among diplomats, among politicians, it can be consequential, right?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, even when we go back to the diplomatic code of impugning somebody's honor, let alone this kind of brazen, public, crude rhetoric. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that can cause a war.
The World's One Man History Desk, Chris Wolf, thank you as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
A group of Black Lives Matter protesters shut down an airport today, not here in the U.S., but in Britain. This morning, several British members of the movement shut down London's City Airport after they chained themselves together on a runway. In a statement, they said they wanted to highlight the way climate change has a disproportionate effect on black people globally, and that, quote, black people are the first to die, not the first to fly, in this racist climate crisis, end quote. Joseph Harker is The Guardian's deputy opinion editor and a former editor of the weekly newspaper Black Britain.
I'm not surprised because it's been such a successful movement in the States in terms of building awareness of the sort of levels of police violence against black people. And it's a feeling that a lot of people in Britain, and I'm sure black people around the world, sympathize with. So it's natural that its success has led people over here to want to reproduce that.
And what is different with the movement there, would you say?
I think the biggest difference is that in the US, there are such shocking and appalling instances of police violence against black people that naturally people are very angry about it and they go onto the streets and they protest about it. I think the difficulty in a way over here is that there's not such extreme levels of police violence. Yes, people do get killed by the police. We saw an example of that just in August with someone being killed by a taser. But there's not the same levels of shootings of unarmed people. And so in a way, it's more difficult to get that same level of emotional engagement in Britain.
Now, the heart of Black Lives Matter in the U.S. Is the African-American community, and many people of color have kind of joined on since. How does that change once you get to the U.K.?
The backdrop is very similar. The black population in Britain is traditionally from the Caribbean, which was, again, an enslaved community that had been enslaved for generations in the Caribbean before they migrated here to Britain. So there's very many similarities in terms of how black people got to the UK compared to how they got to the US.
Now, it's interesting, these Black Lives Matter protests today at London City Airport, they made a connection to climate change that it disproportionately affects people of color across the world. They've also spoken out about the refugee crisis as a Black Lives Matter issue. What do you make of all of this?
I think those issues are true, but I'm not sure how high up climate change is in terms of the black British experience. I think if you asked 100 black people what your top 10 issues are in terms of racism and discrimination you face in Britain, I think environment and climate change would come very low on the list, if at all. I think it is about jobs, it's about criminal justice, it's about education.
Yeah, why do you think they would make this seemingly far reach?
Well, most of the protesters, it turns out, are actually environmental activists, the white environmental activists. And so, in a way, that's caused another issue with whether that means that they really speak for black British people.
So do you think Black Lives Matter in the UK is kind of struggling for relevance?
I think calling yourself Black Lives Matter immediately makes you compare the situation for black people in the UK with black people in the US. It almost downplays the black British experience. But there are lots of issues. There's a new thing which the police are introducing in Britain now, which is called spit hoods, which are these hoods which are put over suspects' heads when they're arrested, and they're reminiscent of Guantanamo hoods. And they look absolutely shocking, and surprise, surprise, the first person who's been seen to have a spit hood placed on the head is a black person, and we just know that they are going to be used more against black people than against white people. So there are a lot of issues which people can be very angry about in terms of what's happening in Britain. It's just surprising that they've chosen airports and climate change as their arena when there are so many other things happening.
Joseph Harker, the deputy opinion editor for The Guardian newspaper, speaking with me from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Josh Davis started out his music career playing with a four-track mixer as a high school student in California. He's since become an internationally known producer who goes by the name DJ Shadow. And one of his recent tracks has caused a huge stir in Ukraine.
Picture this, I'm a bag of dicks. Put me to your lips. I am sick. I will punch a baby bear in it. Give me lip. I'm gonna send you to the yard. Get a stick, make a switch. Nobody speak, nobody get choked.
The track is called Nobody Speak, and if we played any more of it, we'd have to hear a lot more bleeps. Ukrainians are talking about where the video for the tune was shot. Reporter Alex Klimanov knows the location well, and he joins me from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. So you wrote about the video for DJ Shadow's song, Nobody Speak. Give us a quick summary of the action in the video. What do we see?
So the video opens in this giant round hall, which looks pretty much like the United Nations. And you see what appears to be the world leaders sitting around this big round table. And they're sort of preparing for a conference of sorts. And then they just start rapping the verses of the song at each other. It's the representative who is marked the United States talking to the other one marked the United Kingdom. And they are having this conversation that quickly grows into a brawl. They just start yelling at each other, and then they start jumping at each other, and then everybody just joins in, and it's a massive brawl. It's a fist fight, and the papers are flying around. You see a pig jumping in, a chicken that's flying above everyone, and it's just a mess.
Yeah, sheer pandemonium in a place that looks like the UN Security Council. But where is the action for the video set? Where was it shot?
Well, when Ukrainians saw this video, immediately everybody knew this was shot in Kyiv, in what used to be the Lenin Museum. It's just steps away from Independence Square. Right now, it's a convention center called the Ukrainian House, and lots of Ukrainians have been inside. That hall is very recognizable.
There's a great quote from Killer Mike, the MC from Run the Jewels, who performs a song. And Killer Mike famously endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primaries, we should say. Killer Mike said, "It's such a dope video. It's what I really wish Trump and Hillary would just do and get it over with." Do Ukrainians see a metaphor in the video for a Hillary-Trump battle, or do they see it in their own Ukrainian context? And what is that?
Well, because you see representatives of different countries fighting with each other, I don't think Ukrainians think of Trump and Hillary in the first place. They think about what's happening on the world stage. Ukraine, as you know, has been in the center of a crisis. It's been pretty much at war with Russia for the past 2.5 years. And we're noticing what's been going on in the world, the recent coup in Turkey, the elections in the United States, Brexit. It looks like everybody in the world has just gone crazy. It's not any longer about sitting together, talking, discussing, coming to a decision, but just going to a fist fight right away. So Ukrainians are thinking about that, and also about what we often get to see in our parliament, the Verkhovna Rada. Our people's deputies very often start just punching each other in the face when they want to get their point across.
They get that.
Yeah.
There's some symbolism in this video that apparently Ukrainians get, but Americans probably wouldn't, like those pigs and chickens you mentioned, or the broken pencil that comes into play right during the fistfight.
Well, the broken pencil, of course, is something that everybody is thinking about because it happened when our former president, Viktor Yanukovych, was ousted as a result of the Euromaidan revolution, and he went to Russia to seek shelter, pretty much. And then he was giving his first press conference in the city of Rostov, and he was so nervous, and it was visible, and he was so angry, apparently, about what had happened. He was holding a pan in his hands, and he just snapped the pan. Everybody heard that cracking of the pan. So there is that symbolism. And then Vladimir Putin again broke a pencil during one of the talks about the Ukrainian crisis just several months later.
At the end of the video, Alex, and spoiler alert here, all the action comes to a stop when a cleaning lady comes into the Great Hall. Is that just some kind of cute ending, or does she suggest something deeper?
Well, you know, in Ukraine, there is a saying that the cleaning lady always rules because she would never let anyone walk on a clean floor once she cleans it. And also at the same time, it's always up to the cleaning people to pick up the mess left behind the big bosses and the world leaders. So everybody kind of looks at her face and reads what's on her mind that, you know, oh my God, now it's up to me to clean all that. You know, you're ruling the world, and I just have to clean up after you and bear all the burden.
You point out in your Rosen Kingdoms article, Alex, that the hardest part shooting this video is finding actors who look like stodgy politicians and were able also to lip sync lines like, "Put Coke in the doobie roll, Woolies to smoke with Snoopy." How did the directors cope?
Well, I talked to the producers of the music video. It was not only shot here, it was produced by a Ukrainian production company, Radioactive Film, based here in Kyiv. And they said that that really was the biggest challenge because they could easily find great actors and stunts who could jump and fly and dive into brawls. But because they also had to pretty much lip sync to the verses, and those verses were not the simplest ones, they really had to go through a long list of actors who could cope.
So regardless of the fighting and the negative message about politics in the world today, are Ukrainians proud anyway that this building made it into a DJ Shadow video?
Well, I think Ukrainians are proud that a Ukrainian production company produced this video, and it has really played across the world and has drawn so much attention, and the Ukrainian talent is really valued, and that Ukraine is not only mentioned when you talk about crisis and fistfights in the parliament, but also when you talk about these great video production works.
Now, in your article, there's a picture of you, Alex, in a group photo taken at the Ukrainian house in 1982. What were you doing there?
That's back when it still was a Lenin Museum. Actually, it had just opened right before that. I was in third grade. I was just over 10 years old, and we were accepted into the ranks of these young pioneers, the organization created by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, resembling a little bit the American Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. We were supposed to show up all dressed in white shirts, and we all carried these red scarves on our arms, and they were wrapped around our necks, and we had to pronounce the oath of the young pioneer. And it was a very solemn occasion, so everybody was happy that it took place inside that newly built Lenin Museum and not just in our school down the hallway. So it was a pretty memorable day for us as we were kids.
Yeah, when you see this DJ Shadow video now for Nobody Speak, does it feel weird knowing that you were there in the days of the Soviet pioneer times?
It just connects everything in this very weird chain of events. You know, this building has been changing, the history around it has been changing, and it lives on and can still be put to a good use.
Reporter and former young Soviet pioneer Alex Klimanov in Kiev. His article, Battle Rap Kiev, appears in Roads and Kingdoms. You'll find a link on our website, PRI.org. Alex, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
Run the Jewels, whose vocal performance is the juice in that video. They're no strangers to controversy. We put together a collection of some of their more political videos, including Nobody Speak. That's over at PRI.org. You're with the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Paralympians get ready for Rio. In Britain, one competitor gets this reaction.
Wow, that's amazing, that's cool, that's great. What did you do? Like, what event? Did you win?
But in the U.S.
Generally, the first thing I found in the States is the question that gets asked is, oh, what's wrong with you?
We'll have that story, plus Iron Maiden meets Greek traditional music, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Here's a chapter, the Vietnam War, many of us don't remember too well. Part of the U.S. effort to cut off supplies to communist forces in Vietnam involved bombing neighboring Laos. In fact, American bombing runs in the 60s and 70s made Laos the most heavily bombed nation on Earth ever. And today, President Obama said the U.S. has a moral obligation to Laos to help the country deal with millions of unexploded American cluster bombs that still litter the countryside. Washington Post reporter William Wan is traveling with the president. Wan says the U.S. bombing campaign isn't just a thing of the past in Laos.
Yeah, I mean, it ravaged the country at that time, but even more sinister is kind of the legacy effect of that. You know, they carried out, you know, 500,000 bombing missions, and there was 270 million cluster bombs that were dropped, which is just staggering. That's more bombs than all of the bombs dropped in World War II, just in the country of Laos. So if you can imagine that, so 30% of all of these bombs were never exploded. They're just laying out in the field, in villages, children climbing over them, farmers kind of tilling the fields where these are buried. And you don't know until you lose a limb or your life. And so just a really pernicious kind of after effect, like a continual wound in the side of this country.
Yeah, and it's not a kind of an aberration when these things go off, and happens a lot, right?
No, regularly. Up until just a few years ago, it was as many as 300 people dying a year just from these bombs.
Wow.
I've seen pictures of some of these before and after, and you don't see the ground. It's just ground. You know, it's a farm with rice growing in it. And, you know, someone steps over it and suddenly it's an entire, like a meteor has hit that site. Just astonishing.
Well, as Obama himself said, the United States has a moral obligation to help Laos with this unexploded ordnance. What is he proposing? What's the solution?
Well, it's not a solution as it is so much a path towards solution. He's proposed $90 million over 3 years. You know, U.S. has contributed increasing amounts in recent years, but it's a very slow increase of money. This doubles the amount that they're contributing to the funds that are helping clear these unexploded bombs. So it's a significant hike, but the amount of bombs you're talking about that need to be cleared are kind of staggering. So it's kind of a path towards that.
And does Laos, does the government in Laos see that that kind of money is enough to solve the problem?
I think the way both governments are thinking about this is a significant problem, but it's also an opportunity for both sides. There's not been that much talk between the two. The ties are not that strong. This is the common bond they have, is the secret war that went on. You know, not a great bond to build on, but like that's their history. And so I think for both sides, this is kind of seen as an opportunity for U.S.-Lao ties and something they can work on together that they can build on for a future relationship.
Yeah, so if solving the problem of unexploded ordnance is kind of the first step in U.S.-Thai relations, what does the future hold? What do like the people of Laos want from the U.S.?
It's difficult because, you know, when you talk about what do Lao people want, you know, there's such a divide between the people running the country, the elites, and the people on the ground. And it's a country that has a lot of difficulties. It's corrupt, extremely repressive. And so it's difficult when the U.S. talks about what the people want here, because the U.S. has to be very careful not to say, you know, they want something even hinting at a regime change. They're pushing for more democratization, more humane treatment of people, their own people. So, you know, it's hard when you say, what do people want? The leaders want the economy to go better. They want to stabilize the country and raise people's livelihood in a way that keeps them in power. So it's a very complicated mix. The problem is if you improve the country that much, the kind of corrupt practices that help them become rich because they're in power, those avenues are cut off. And so it's a kind of a juggling act. You know, you don't want people so angry and dissatisfied that, you know, it's open kind of anger and revolt, but you want the system in place so that you can benefit from it.
You know, we hear so little from Laos. This is probably your first time there too, right?
It is. It's kind of strange because it's a mix of all these countries that people often visit. You know, Americans, they go to Vietnam, they go to Thailand, they're strong tourist sites. Laos is kind of this place where it's in between all of that and it has influences from all of that. Really, the three biggest influencers in its culture and geopolitics is China, Vietnam, and Thailand. And so you see this mix of it with kind of the native culture as well.
What struck you most profoundly since you've been there?
That's difficult. You know, it's the mundane things. I mean, just the way that the rain starts and stops on a dime. I don't know. I feel like maybe this is projecting, but I feel like it kind of affects the way you think of life. I mean, things can change at any moment, and it is very unpredictable here, I must say. There's this feeling of that.
Well, it is a historic day of sorts. It is the first time an American president is in Laos. It's also the first time Washington Post reporter William Wan is there, too. William Wan traveling with the president for the Post in the city of Vientiane, Laos. William, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
The Greek island of Crete sits in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, sort of a transit point between Turkey and Italy, or between North Africa and the Greek mainland. As a result, Crete has seen its share of migrants coming ashore, and the island has also had its share of refugee camps. I spoke about this not long ago with Greek composer and musician Stelios Petrakis, who's from Crete. Petrakis says even with Greece still in the throes of a major economic crisis, it's impossible for Greeks not to feel for the refugees.
We are all sensitive, especially the artists who we are trying to give some concerts in order to collect useful things for the refugees from Syria.
Has it affected your music? I mean, have you written, composed songs about what's going on?
Not yet. I mean, the general crisis, I try to not be so immediately affected. My music is deep, it has emotion. My lyrics are mainly for love and some for the respect of the environment, for kindness of people and for the beauty of Crete.
Stelios Petrakis plays the lyre and lute, some of the oldest continuously played instruments in the world. He also builds them, but music wasn't his original career path. In fact, Petrakis went to law school before becoming a professional musician.
So are you a practicing lawyer at the same time?
No. At a very critical moment that I had to decide, because I had a concert at the same day of some exams. So I preferred to go to the concert instead of the exams. You know.
Eventually, he did get his law degree, but his passion for music still keeps him from hanging out his shingle. And that passion, it's not just for the traditional music of Crete.
I'm a big fan of the British band Iron Maiden. I listen a lot to flamenco music from Spain and a lot to music from Turkey, folk music and classical Ottoman music. So it's a strange combination, I can understand, but I find some things into that music that I really like, and I really going deeper and deeper.
Okay, so where would we hear the influences of Iron Maiden in your music?
Maybe in the power, you know, maybe in the power.
A soupçon of Iron Maiden there, perhaps, and a powerful piece from composer Stelios Petrakis in Crete. Most of the refugees who arrive in Crete and other parts of Greece don't want to stay there. They'd rather head to Europe's more northern countries, like Germany. More than 1 million refugees and migrants seeking asylum entered Germany last year. Their arrival strained many public services. German schools have coped by grouping new arrivals in special welcome classes where they learn the language and get used to a new system before being plunged into regular classrooms. Sonja Narang went to see a welcome class in action at an elementary school in a small town south of Berlin.
Es gibt Lieder über Autos, bum, bum, bum. Und auch Lieder übers Pinchen, zum, zum, zum.
The children in the welcome class are sitting in a circle on the floor. They're of different ages, between 6 and 12. Though it's early morning, these kids are singing their hearts out in German. It's a language they just started learning. Six months ago, Eigenhurt Primary School took in 16 refugee kids from a neighboring town where the schools were already overcrowded. It was daunting at first, but the school quickly found a young college grad, Caroline Discher, who could teach a special German language class. She hesitated at first.
I wasn't really sure if this is the right job for me. I was really afraid because I heard of other classes like this, that the students don't know any rules, that their behavior is really bad, and that I thought, oh my goodness, what happens if the students don't listen to me because I'm a woman? But it isn't like this at all.
Discher got over her fears, and even though she'd never taught before, her guitar and music training came in handy.
Meine Mami ist niemals fremd. It is great. It is really the best work ever. The students, they are listening. They really want to go to school. At the beginning, it was really the way that when they came to school, they just said, oh, Miss Discher, Miss Discher. And they really said they want to go. And weekend was bad because they couldn't go to school.
Ah, wie viele Leute. Ach, was wollen die heute?
Her students are from Afghanistan, Syria, and Chechnya, and they are the only non-German kids in the entire school. But they seem right at home in the cozy environment of this classroom.
Und drüber gehen dürfen heute. Hatere.
After the songs and games, the teacher splits the class into smaller groups.
Romy, Rolt. Rollt.
Rollt.
Genau.
Rummi. We show them everything, how it works here. And later on, they can go to their classes, so they can make friends. That's the important thing, that they get a normal social life, and not only the life over there in the shelter.
Later, the refugee children disperse into different classrooms around the school. I follow two second graders, Assad and Mohammed, upstairs to an English class. Assad is from Syria, and Mohammed is from Afghanistan.
Good morning.
As the children around them chatter away fluently in German, the two refugee students try to keep up. Assad, the most talkative, cheerful student in the welcome class, suddenly becomes quiet and shy. Then their teacher begins speaking yet another foreign language.
There are some words that we have to talk about.
The teachers tell me all the kids get along, but in this mixed classroom, I see it's going to take some time for the German students to completely accept the new kids as peers.
Today we want to start something new, a new topic.
During activities, no one pairs up with the refugee kids until the teacher prompts them. At one point, Mohammed starts crying when he can't understand the question the teacher asks him. Today's lesson is on travel, and when the students start talking about their vacations in Spain, Greece, Italy, and New York, the refugee students are clearly left out. Assad raises his hand, but the teacher doesn't call on him.
Leah.
Okay.
None of this is easy, according to the school principal, Karen Korga.
Es ist eine große Verantwortung, auch Flüchtlingskinder an einer Schule zu unterrichten.
It is a big responsibility for the school to teach refugee children, she says. Nowadays, the teachers must be ready to differentiate very much during the lessons, because there are children of very different abilities all in the same classroom. Korga's been teaching for 2 decades, but this is all very new.
Aber es ist gleichzeitig auch eine große Freude.
She says, we are overjoyed to see how enthusiastic these children are to learn, and how happy they are to come to school. Back in the bubble of the welcome class, teacher Caroline Discher tells me why she takes her new role seriously.
My job here is to show them how beautiful the world can be, that they are safe here. That's really important for the children. I really want to fight for them, to show them everything here, so that they really can get on. We have so intelligent kids here.
As I leave, one watercolor on her classroom window pane stands out above the rest. It's a rainbow painted in the colors of the German flag, with a smiling stick figure underneath. For the world, this is Sonja Narang, Kleinmachnow, Germany.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. I bought a new wetsuit this summer so I can surf in the waters of New England, but I wore it only once in August because the water this summer has been so warm. Don't take it from me, though. Just look at the melting glaciers and bleached corals around the globe. And there are other ways we know the ocean is getting warmer. It's just that they're not so visible, like whole species of fish, seabirds, and turtles moving to live in cooler waters closer to the poles. These changes are highlighted in a new report released this week by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Villanova University ecologist Samantha Chapman was one of 80 scientists who helped write it. So, Samantha, give us the 30,000-foot view here. What are some of the biggest reasons scientists are worried about ocean warming?
The oceans provide a lot of services for us as humans. Some of them are really obvious, like providing the fish that we eat. But some of them, I guess I would say, are less obvious, like the fact that the oceans help regulate our climate by absorbing the carbon dioxide that we put more of into the atmosphere.
So one stat in this report really caught our eye. It's that the ocean has absorbed more than 90% of greenhouse gas heating since the 1970s. But if it had been the lower atmosphere absorbing that much warming, Earth would have warmed nearly 100 degrees. I mean, help us get our head around that.
Yeah, Marco, you mentioned earlier your wetsuit. And I think that if you go to the beach at this time of year, the ocean's pretty warm. And if you went in a month or two, the ocean would still be pretty warm because the molecules in water have a high specific heat. They can absorb heat really well. The other reason why the oceans are so good at absorbing all of this extra heat is that they're just so massive, right? Two-thirds of our planet is made up of the ocean.
So you're saying the oceans have kind of saved us since the 1970s?
They have, to some extent. And I think that the thing that this report does such a good job of is thinking about what is the cost of that.
So short answer to what is the cost, and then I have another question.
I think the cost is, one, the effects that we're seeing on the species in the oceans. The other effect that's really disconcerting is how this affects sea level rise.
So the other thing this report does really nicely is remind us how interrelated ocean ecosystems are and how one small change triggers many others potentially. One example, explain what happens when species like fish and plankton move north or south to live or breed in cooler waters.
All animals are very reliant on the things that can photosynthesize or make food. And so when plankton move to different places, and for example, the animals that eat them aren't cued by the same cues such as temperatures, but rather by navigating by the stars or by the amount of daylight, then they don't move at the same rate. And therefore, the things that they eat are no longer there.
Yeah. So one animal species moves away. The other is like, where'd you go?
Exactly. Yes.
Samantha Chapman, an ecologist at Villanova University in Pennsylvania, one of the authors of the new report out on ocean warming from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Samantha, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Marco.
The Paralympic Games start tomorrow in Rio, and one of the teams competing in crew trained right here in Boston. The Paralympics feature athletes with different disabilities, but a fan would have a hard time identifying what disabilities members of this particular team have. And as WGBH's Craig LaMolt reports, the athletes say that's entirely beside the point.
Rowing coach Ellen Minsner drives a motorboat down the Charles River alongside two men in a crew boat as she calls out instructions to them.
That's good, doing good. Nice way to stay level. That's good. Back now, same thing. Don't reach and put the stroke up in the upper body.
They each pull a single oar, powerfully and in perfect unison.
Yes, good, 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 good.
For this practice, their two female teammates are rowing in a separate boat. They look like Olympians, but each one of them has a disability. And this week, they're in Rio to compete in the Paralympics. Zachary Burns was born with a club foot.
So I only have a club foot on my left leg, which was originally corrected when I was a young child through surgery. But as a result of that surgery, the left ankle has far less flexibility than a typical ankle.
He also has some muscle atrophy in his left leg, all of which limits his ability to push with that leg, something that's key to the stroke. It's a similar thing for all four of the rowers. Their disabilities may not be clearly visible, but they're real, and they're something they have to adapt to as they compete. Dani Hansen was born with damaged nerves in her left arm, a condition called Bell's palsy.
And I was told I wouldn't be able to use my arm at all for my entire life.
But she didn't listen, and now she rows for the varsity team at the University of Washington, a national powerhouse in the sport. Even she didn't think of herself as a disabled person, because she'd always managed to compensate for the weakness in her left arm by using her right one more. But when she realized she could qualify for Paralympic rowing, she jumped at the opportunity. She does have a disability, she says, and it can be hard that people don't understand that.
We have to explain to people what it is, and that's not always like the most fun thing to do. Like, actually, it's difficult for me to do a push-up. I didn't do a push-up till I was 21 years old. Like, it's really, like, there are things that I might look like I'm able to do, but I haven't figured out yet.
Teammate Dorian Weber was born in the U.S. with two club feet, but grew up mostly in
jolly old England.
And he says people in the U.K. are excited when they hear he's a Paralympian.
They're like, wow, that's amazing, that's cool, that's great, what did you do, like, what event, did you win, and, you know, as if you would speak to a baseball star or a basketball star.
But he gets a very different reaction in the U.S.
Generally, the first thing I found in the States is the question that gets asked is, oh, what's wrong with you?
Weber says Americans expect Paralympians to be missing a limb or in a wheelchair. And, of course, there are a lot of athletes like that, but there's a whole spectrum of disability. This boat is in a category for the least disabled athletes, the ones who have use of their legs, trunks, and arms. And there's a point system ranking their disabilities to make sure they qualify.
It's not like me with my club foot is going to be racing someone who is, you know, paralyzed from the waist down.
Jacqueline Smith is the fourth rower on the boat.
People confuse
the Paralympics and the Special Olympics.
The Special Olympics is for people with intellectual disabilities and tends to be more about finding the courage and strength to compete. The Paralympics, Smith says, is for athletes who probably could be in the Olympics if it weren't for a disability they have to adapt to. And the Paralympics isn't just about competing. It's about winning.
I don't know if this is really even politically correct to say, but in order to do well in this boat class and to medal and, you know, push the world records, you really need to find the four least disabled people that can row.
It's not like they're gaming the system. It's how it works in their category. And she says the countries they're competing with are doing the same thing. Smith has ocular albinism, which means she doesn't have any pigment in her skin or eyes and is legally blind.
Here we go.
She reaches into her bag and pulls out a pair of sunglasses with stars and stripes on the lenses.
So it's completely blacked out on the inside, so I cannot see anything when I am rowing with these on.
Since she's not fully blind, she has to wear these as a blindfold to level the playing field. She doesn't like wearing them, but those are the rules. Smith says because they have to adapt to compensate for their disabilities, they wind up working even harder than other elite athletes.
I think that, you know, America as a society needs to stop looking at us as, you know, what's wrong with you and start to really appreciate what we can do.
The team will show what they can do this week in Rio. The U.S. boat has come in silver in the last two national championships, and this time they plan to beat out their rival Great Britain and win the gold. For The World, Craig LaMolt, Boston.
And I'm Marco Werman. That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.